tonight on Arena, Barry McGovern and Michael James Ford on a play called Stumped, and Maria Walsh on writing the anthem for the Irish soccer team in Australia. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In the play Stumped, writer Seumat Dutta puts cricket enthusiasts Samuel Beckett and Harold Pinter together, and the two characters spar and word spin as they wait to go into bat. A production of the play opens in Dublin next Wednesday. It's performed by two actors who also happen to be cricket enthusiasts, Barry McGovern and Michael James Ford, both of whom are sitting opposite me now. Not in whites, which I'm very disappointed by. I thought you'd come in full cricket attire, but no, they're just in their ordinary
kit. They got destroyed in the weather.
They're in their ordinary. Rain didn't stop you coming in, though. I'm delighted about that. For Michael, I think it was you that came across the play first. This Seumat Dutta, if I'm saying his name correctly. Tell us a little bit about him and the play that he has kind of imagined here.
Well, I met him actually. There was in the Beckett Festival in Fermanagh about 8 or 9 years ago. Someone had the great idea of pitching the Theatrical Cavaliers,
who are a cricket team,
yeah, which is the
full of actors here in Dublin.
Dublin's cricket casuals against Harold Pinter's Gaieties, and it was going to be a complete mismatch. The Gaieties are an extremely good team.
Are they London based?
They're London based.
Showbiz people, is that
showbiz people? But Harold Pinter was their captain and president for many years. And when I was thinking about this game, I discovered that the Gaieties had actually played the Lord's Taverners, including three ex-England captains, in a memorial match for Harold Pinter, and beat them.
So these were serious players.
So I was desperately trying to get a few ringers in for the Cavaliers. I rang Maureen Joyce, mother of all the Joyces, but she didn't have a spare son for the occasion. And I signed up a few club players from up north. But then, thankfully, the game was rained off. But we had a great evening in the pub with lots of reminiscences about Harold and Samuel Beckett. And I think that's when Seumat started to hatch the play.
So it was that particular rained off match and then the subsequent conversations.
He had a plan initially as a sketch for Harold and Beckett.
Yeah, it's grown into much more than that, Barry. And both Beckett and Pinter were cricket players and quite good, I believe.
Well, Harold Pinter, I believe, was a great man for his hitting sixes. Beckett, strangely enough, never played after 1928 when he was only 22, because he was at Trinity College in Dublin. He played. The reason he's in Wisden, the cricketer's Bible, and is deemed to be the only Nobel Prize winner in Wisden, is because he played two matches for Trinity against Northamptonshire in 1925 and 1926, and because it was deemed to be a first class match, so they were well beaten in both. But Beckett played age 19 and 20 in both matches, and then when he taught in Campbell College in 1928 in Campbell College in Belfast, I think he turned out for one of the school teams, or maybe school pupils against masters or something. I think that's the last time he played cricket. So yes, he played cricket as a young man, but he never continued. But he loved the game.
Yeah, he didn't continue playing, but he continued watching. Of course, cricket in and of itself, in some ways, it has the feeling of a Beckett play or a Pinter play, indeed, off it. Lots of sitting around waiting for things to happen.
Lots of tension, a fair bit of menace.
Yeah,
and that's the wonderful thing. Like Seumat has put these two great playwrights in the back of beyond in the Cotswolds, and Pinter's only played one game for the club at this point, and he's brought his mate Samuel Beckett, who he thinks is still a great cricketer. Mm. So there's enormous pressure on Beckett to prove his record, and also pressure on Pinter because he's showing off, having brought Sam down.
And Beckett, I think when he did play, Barry, is it right to say that he was the first on? He was one of the opening batsmen. Was he quite high up the batting order?
He occasionally was an opening bat, but I think he was further down the order normally. Right. But the funny thing about Beckett was he was a right-handed man. I mean, he wrote with his right hand and was right-handed, but he batted left-handed, bowled right-handed. But his brother Frank, who was a few years older than him, had taught him to bat left-handed. So That's
and I
what
presume
happened.
That makes it awkward for the bowler, or is it?
Well, it can do. Yeah. You tend to bowl around the wicket to a left-hander and things like that. Little subtleties we needn't go into here.
Yeah, because we lose those who know nothing about cricket.
But you don't have to. You don't have to know. It helps, but it doesn't. You don't have to know about cricket or Beckett or Pinter to enjoy the play.
Yeah. So maybe the setup, because we'll get you to read a little piece for us, which is quite early on in the play, Michael James. Maybe you set up for us what the kind of dynamic is in Act One of the play, because like many is the Beckett play, well, the famous one anyway, where nothing happens twice. In this one, things do happen across the two acts. But what is happening in Act One?
In Act One, Pinter's team awaiting a batting. They're chasing a total of 170. And
is that a
reasonable
so
total?
So they still could win it.
Yes, and Sam Beckett is next in. Pinter's in after him. Beckett is keeping the score, but he's increasingly anxious, because as soon as a wicket falls, he's going to go in.
Right.
And Pinter is annoyingly blasé about the situation, whereas Beckett is very, very focused.
Well, Beckett is next on.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
He'd be a little bit more focused because of that. Let's hear the section then that you've chosen to read. There's a little bit of language just towards the end of this, be warned.
So we're looking at, I'm looking at the scorebook and I say, I'm looking at the field and say, which of these players is which?
This end is Fred Palozzi and the other end is young Dick Wise.
Number four.
At least that's what they call him. Joined before me. I think he's a medical student.
So neither is the man who might give us a lift.
Fred's probably going back to the skipper.
The skipper?
Laurie Lupino Lane.
Batting at...
Son of Lupino Lane.
Number nine.
The music hall star who set up the club. I found out earlier that Laurie's just taken on a dwarf who used to perform with his father as his butler.
Is that so?
Apparently, he's less than 3 feet tall.
Well, what about Dick Wise?
I doubt he has a butler.
But does he drive?
When I spoke to Laurie about a lift back to London, he said this other chap was our best bet.
What other chap?
Our putative driver.
And what's he called?
I've no idea.
It must be one of these.
It stands to reason.
Though there is the odd gap in the batting order.
Laurie said he'd ask him on our behalf.
Has that happened yet?
I'm not sure.
But you know him by sight.
Not as such. Still, we must have seen him, assuming he's playing.
Well, can we at least give him a name? For morale, if nothing else.
Do you have one in mind?
Well, what about Doggo?
Doggo?
A reflection of his attitude.
As in lying Doggo?
He's eluded us thus far. Can you not pad up before applying those bloody peas?
They're not peas. They're petit pois.
Oh, just put on the fucking pads.
That's Barry McGovern and Michael James Ford as Beckett and Pinter, respectively, in the play Stumped, which will be performed at Beauties in the coming weeks. Barry and Michael with me in studio this evening. So they are actually waiting for Doggo in the case of this play.
Yes, there's a mysterious two batsmen missing in the order in the scorebook, and they're wondering who they are. So who this mysterious Doggo is part of the mystery of the play.
And I think that Shomit does he does quite a lot of that kind of reference to the plays of Beckett and Pinter in particular along the way. Has a lot of fun with that, Michael.
Yes, he does. He referenced a number of plays, but particularly Godo, and they're echoes of the dialogue in Godo in the exchanges.
Yeah, even a little bit of that exchange had a feel of Vladimir and Estragon off it, didn't it? You know.
Yeah, and at one stage he imagines Vladimir and Estragon going and padded up and going into bat. There's a little fantasy sequence and it's a timeless test and Lords and they're about to go out. But he also, there's the homecoming. Pinter describes the plot of the homecoming. He's trying to impress Beckett with his new play. And there's a good bit of the dumb waiter as strange things start to happen.
Yeah, I think the second act has maybe a little bit more Barry of the feel of Pinter. The first act certainly feels like Beckett. The second act feels a bit more like Pinter.
Yes, I think so, yeah. And at the end of the dumb way, there's these two characters who are waiting to get the message. They're basically assassins.
They don't know who they're going to assassinate.
And then the mystery at the end of the play, which I won't spoil, but there's the echoes of that in this play throughout. So mainly Waiting for Godot and The Dumbwaiter with other plays involved as well.
Yeah, and I suppose in terms of both playwrights, they would be, if popular is the right word, certainly among the very best known plays of the two writers and the most often performed. Yeah. What about the links between Beckett and Pinter themselves? What are they and how strong were they?
Was a great admirer of Beckett, and as early as the early 50s, when he was a very young man, because he was born in 1930, he wrote a wonderful piece about Beckett that he quoted on television and radio after Beckett died. And I can't remember what it was, but the more he grinds my nose in the dirt, the more I like him. You know, he leaves no stone unturned and no maggot lonely. You know, his work is beautiful, and he was a great admirer of his. And he used to send his plays to Beckett always, and he used to accept Beckett's advice. There was a famous incident in one of the plays where Peter Hall sent Pinter sent something to Beckett, and Beckett suggested, look at page 9, line 32. And he said, no, there's nothing wrong with that, that's fine. And later in rehearsals, Peter Hall said to Pinter, I'm worried about one line. And Pinter said, is it page 9, line 32? He said, yes. He says, change it.
So he was quite happy.
Yeah, they were great admirers of each other's work, yeah.
And would you see similarities? I mean, particularly the pause is often the big thing that's mentioned in terms of Pinter. Does it serve the same type of purpose in a Pinter play as it does in a Beckett play? How similar are they? I know it's hard to kind of speak in those general terms.
There's too much emphasis put on that. I mean, Beckett was a great man when he was directing his plays to cut a lot of the pauses and say they're too long, you know. And Pinter, it's something you feel instinctively as an actor, and you yourself, having acted so much, that you would know this. And any actor would sense how long it should be. What's the difference between a pause and a silence, you know, in Pinter? Yeah. You know, it's common sense, really. I mean, it's really to rake up the tension in a given situation, as opposed to taking it literally. You know, it's like a pause in music. How long is a Beethoven pause?
Yeah,
you know?
it's the right length.
It is, whatever it is, yeah. And different conductors will use it differently, yeah.
Yeah, a pause and a silence, I suppose the difference between the two on radio is panic, really.
Well, that's true. Yes, dead air, yeah.
In terms of the characters then, that you're obviously, Barry is playing Beckett, you're playing Pinter. To what extent do you get into any kind of serious research into the background of Pinter? Are you purely dealing with the text and this? Because there's a lot of fun being had around the whole cricket idea here, Michael.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of fun, but something about their particular obsessions has been, you know, is what we've explored. And Pinter, you know, there's something of the wide boy about Pinter, but he's a bit of a bruiser as well. He's a forceful character, but he's also in awe of Beckett, so he's mad keen to impress. But I think it's the skill of Chomet's writing that these different aspects of their respective characters emerge in this, you know, seemingly bucolic scene in the Cotswolds watching a game of cricket.
And there's a note on the first page of Chomet's script where he says, throughout Act One, Pinter and Beckett, while focused on the game, seem locked in a tacit duel where Pinter inclines to direct confrontation while Beckett prefers parry and surprise.
Which is, in some ways, a description.
And it's
of
the
both.
Younger man. I mean, it's set in 1964. I mean, obviously, it's imaginary. Mm. But Beckett would have been 58 and Pinter would have been 34. He's getting his hair dyed. It's okay. But So I'm a bit too old, and or a bit too old. We're both a bit too old for the parts, but it doesn't matter. It is what it is. And I mean, you know, you're playing Pinter and I'm playing Beckett as characters in this play.
Yeah.
Rather than we're not doing
it's not
a play
an impersonation.
About the real Samuel yes. Beckett or the real Harold Pinter.
Yeah. But what kind of Beckett does the Shomit, I think you're to call him, the Shomit Dutta give you? How close do you think it is? Because obviously you've met the man,
well,
you know, and you know the work really
yeah.
well.
Well, he knew Pinter well. I knew Pinter, but not well.
Hmm.
I knew Beckett a little as well. But, I mean, I think he's got the essence of what he needs for his play from them. And, you know, you don't have to go into sort of psychological depth about this. It's just, it is a serious piece, but it's a fun piece. And mainly it's a fun piece. But it's a lovely, there's a lovely intellectual edge to it in the best sense of that word. It's good fun.
You have a second this, and is this second piece that you have for us is from the second act of the play, is it?
So, yes, it is. Yeah.
So while we had a flavour of Beckett, I suppose, in the first act, is the second act goes much
the
more into a Pinterest?
The second act, it is now approaching midnight. They're both a bit drunk. The game has gone disastrously wrong, and it's Pinter who's really made a mess of it.
So are we post-batting now at this stage?
So the game's all over.
Oh,
game's
so it's all finished
over.
Now.
We've been in the pub
yeah.
and we're trying to get home. And this is where Doggo
comes. We're waiting for Doggo. So suddenly out of the blue, Beckett says, "Man alive, is that a gibbet?"
"Where? Would they have executed people on the village green?"
"I wouldn't put it past them. This is England.
And that's where our number 7 would like to see me rot.
A fitting end for both of us."
"Why you?"
"I was born on Friday the 13th of April. Not just Friday the 13th, but Good Friday. No one comes back from that.
Except Jesus." "I've just realised."
"What?"
"We never worked out Doggo's actual name."
"We didn't put a face to him either."
"What's wrong?"
"I'm having doubts."
"What about?"
"The arrangement."
"I thought you only agonised beforehand."
"This was your arrangement."
"The message was clear."
"From the skipper?"
"Well, actually, it was from one of the others, but he had it on good authority from the skipper, who had it straight from Doggo himself, to wait on the village green between closing time and 12 by the willow tree."
"Why was it not discussed with Doggo in person?"
"He left before the end of the game to visit his aunt. He was meant to be going for lunch, but moved lunch to dinner because we were one short."
"Is this nearby?"
"Somewhere between Upper Slaughter, Lower Swell, and Oddington."
"I'm none the wiser."
"Not far from Adlestrop."
"Adlestrop?"
"Just north of here, on the branch line to Oxford."
"I read somewhere that Edward Thomas took the train journey described in Adlestrop in 1914. It was late June, the poem says. It could have been 50 years ago to the day. No one left and no one came on the bare platform. It stayed with me, that line."
Brian McGovern and Michael James Ford as Beckett and Pinter in the play Stumped. Really in that scene, you do get a sense there, I think, Michael, we are in a, I don't know if darker is the right idea, but you're certainly in a much tenser world than you are in the first act, despite the fact that they're waiting to go on to bat. But there's more at stake, it seems, in this second act of the play.
The hints of a potential nightmare as things develop.
Which feeds into the dumb waiter parallel,
absolutely,
I guess,
in terms of
what you're getting. And Barbara Nikeev is directing here, your own wife, Michael. What kind of setting do we have? Are we in a very crickety setting, given that the play is called Stumped? Or how has that been? How are you handling that side of things?
Obviously we're in Bewley's, which is a very small space, but it's quite a naturalistic setting. We have a bit of an old pavilion. We have some fantastic aged director's chairs. We have an old scoreboard, and hopefully and we have a lovely soundtrack with the sounds of the game and
do we get
bird
the puck
song.
The puck of the ball and the
puck
that sound, because it is a lovely relaxing sound, it has to be said. Dare I ask about the state of the Theatrical Cavaliers, the cricket team associated with SAPE?
the theatrical cavaliers never healthier. We've got a very good contingent of players. Yeah, thriving. Founded back in 1987, would you believe, by myself and Al McKenna, who's known to RTE.
Yeah.
And in fact, RTE are our arch rivals, and we meet them every the end of August for a trophy called the Marlowe Trophy, which is fiercely contested.
Nearly as important as the Ashes, is it?
Oh, to us, even more important.
Well, may the best team win that one. I shall have to remain totally objective in terms of who I might cheer for in that particular case. Thanks to both of you for coming into us this evening. That's Byron McGovern and Michael James Ford. And Stumped, or to give it its subtitle, Yes, No, Wait, with Barney McGovern and Michael James Ford, will run from July the 26th through until August the 19th. Previews on July the 24th and 25th. You can see it at Beauty's Cafe Theatre in Dublin, 1 p.m. Monday to Saturday. And there will be soiree performances, 7 p.m. on Thursday, August the 3rd. You're listening to Wednesday Night's Arena.
Now it's O'Sullivan. And there's the run of Barrett. And Barrett's given herself a chance here. Amber Barrett in on goal. Amber Barrett makes the breakthrough. That was sheer brilliance from Amber Barrett. The first touch to take her clear was absolutely terrific. And Amber Barrett kneels in celebration in honour of the Donegal folk who passed away in the disaster in Chrysler. What a moment for the Donegal girl.
It's one of the most important goals in Irish women's football history.
Never was a truer word spoken. One of the most important goals in Irish women's soccer and in football history. That was the goal scored by Amber Barrett that secured the Irish team their place in the World Cup in Australia. Finally, the tournament is here. 11 a.m. tomorrow, the Republic of Ireland begin their Group B challenge when they take on co-hosts Australia. But what would a World Cup challenge be if our team didn't have an anthem to cheer them? My next guest, Maria Walsh, one part of the duo Zrazy, has written such an anthem, Come On Ireland, giving us the right to dream, featuring none other than Uachtaráin na hÉireann, Michael D. Higgins. And delighted to have Maria with us in studio this evening. And Maria, it has to be said, as that goal was scored in the commentary from George Hamilton, you were clearly reliving the moment with your cheering. Do you remember? Do you remember where you were when that goal, or did you see it happen live?
Oh, I did see it happen live. I was at home, and I just, you know, roared and shouted and danced up and down, you know, just magnificent.
And did a little song, even at that point, were you already thinking, I feel an anthem coming upon me?
No, not yet.
So at what point did you start to feel an anthem coming upon you?
I did have a notion that I said it to Carol Nelson, the other half of Zrazy. So I said, look, you know, maybe, you know, we could reprise. I mean, we did do the 1990 Italia Paul McGrath under a different name. So we should do something for the women. And she said, oh, well, she was very busy with her Carol Nelson piano trio thing. And so I put it to the back of my mind, and then I read this great interview with Louise Quinn in the Irish Times paper, and it was the moment I put that down. It was a brilliant interview, and I put the paper down and went to the computer, and the words just started flying out.
So it was the lyrics that came to you
lyrics
first?
Lyrics came first, yeah.
And then melody came after the event. And how quickly did you employ or ask for the words of President Uachtaráin na hÉireann, President Michael D. Higgins?
That happened when Niall Stokes of Hot Press decided to come on board and support the whole thing because they've got a new record label.
So, okay, let us listen to the anthem in full, featuring those words by Michael D. Higgins. And Siobhan Hearn, she's one of the singers in the midst, or we hear her words in the midst of this as well,
yes,
don't we?
Yes, she's a vlogger.
A vlogger. Let's have a listen. Here we go.
Waiting all our girls to grow.
Come on, Ireland, giving us the right to dream, the anthem for the Irish soccer team playing in the World Cup in Australia with their first match tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. The writer of that tune is with me in studio, Maria Walsh. And Maria Walsh, composer of Come On Ireland, giving us the right to dream, the anthem that we played just ahead of Nuke there, is with me in studio. I was saying as we were listening to the anthem, you can hear the sections, Maria, where you're kind of hoping this is where the people on the terraces might start joining in. This is the section that people like the Come On Ireland refrain. You'd be hoping that people might kind of pick up on that and start using it as a kind of a terrace chant. Yeah. I guess you have to think that way when you're composing an anthem like that.
Definitely. I knew it was going to be a sing-along. I needed a sing-along, a chant, basically, that people would take up, hopefully. That would be my dream, to hear the people in the stadium taking it up, you know. So there's two different types. There's the chorus, Come On Ireland, you know, giving us the right to dream, and you're our team. And then the other one is just the hey, 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 giving us the right to dream.
But it's interesting that in both of those cases you have, which is the section of the song, I have to say, that speaks to me most, this giving us the right to dream, because that speaks way beyond football, doesn't it, really? Way beyond any one sport, any one activity, in fact.
Yeah, that's right. I felt I wanted to capture that aspiration that we as a small country love and have, and we do often, sometimes, you could say, you know, manage to box above our weight. Is that how they say it? Particularly for this Irish women's team, who've come from, you know, it's taken 50 years to get to this point, and all the lack of funding and lack of support, you know, that happened for girls in sport and women in sport. So for the Irish team to bring us to this point is just fantastic and a huge achievement. So, yeah, it's given us the really, we can dream about this. This has given us a stake in the
you'll be glued to the television clearly tomorrow morning then at 11
a.m. Totally.
Yeah. And we mentioned Siobhan O'Hearn, who we hear the words of Uachtaráin on the Hearn, and again, beautiful kind of aspirational and hopeful nature in those words.
Yes.
And the Siobhan, who is a sister of one of the team members.
That's right. She's a twin sister of Ruaisha Littlejohn, and she's a great example of the Irish diaspora. And it's fantastic to hear her, you know, Glaswegian accent. She was really happy to do it, and she's a great sport. And she does this great vlog. I just came across her by accident, and she's very good, very funny, and excellent.
Let's have a listen. Let's go back a little bit. And initially, you know, we all know one section of this song. There's no question about that, which is when it gets into the chorus. But as I was listening today, I realised, yeah, of course, there's a whole verse before we get to the chorus. Let's have a listen. That is such an amazing chant, Ooh Ah Paul McGrath. I mean, it's used now all the time, if you think about it. Even without Paul McGrath, it's still a chant that we hear regularly.
Yeah.
Was that something you had? I should explain that Maria Walsh was also involved in the composition of that piece, and you singing there as well.
Yeah, that's my voice sounding 33 years, is it? Younger. 32 years younger.
My voice has dropped
a little bit since that.
Carol Nelson wrote it. Yeah. We were managed by Eamon Carr at the time. Mm. And Polygram approached Eamon to ask us to come up with a song based around the terrace chant. I mean, that we took that from the terraces.
Yeah, in that case, you had that chant and you just adapted it into the song, built the song around it.
Yeah.
It is a phenomenal chant, really, isn't it?
You know? Well, it is originally from Oops Upside Your Head. I said Oops Upside Your Head. That's the original from the Gap Band.
Yeah.
That was their number. And then the soccer crowd turned that into Ooh-Ah.
Yeah, and it made total sense within that. I also asked you, I should have said this when we were talking about Come On Ireland and the current anthem. I asked you, Who's on that track with you? Is that you singing, I asked? You said, yes, that's me singing. And
yeah,
what else are you doing?
I did everything except Carol Nelson has played the fabulous tin whistle, which is just perfect on it. And the only other contributors are, well, I got a backing vocal chorus when Carol and I were going down to West Cork to do some music for a short film by Toma McCullum. I don't know if you know Toma. Her partner is Carmel Winters.
Oh, yes, the playwright and
director. So we were working on a piece of, just developing some music down in West Cork. And there was a gang, the West Cork, Toma's gang, Salt and Pepper, the queer community of West Cork, full of creatives and, you know, great people. So I asked them I need a group backing vocals. So we just recorded in the room that we're in. And I then took that back to Tipperary, where I finished the song in Ballyporeen, in a studio in Ballyporeen in Tipperary.
It is the sort of backing vocals that you would love to hear the team doing at some point along the way. That would be a dream, I'm guessing, yeah?
That'd be a dream.
Have they heard the song yet, or do you know what the plans are there?
We don't know. I do know, yes, that Ruesha was going to be, she was going to be hearing it. Or
This is Ruesha Littlejohn, the Ruesha twin sister Littlejohn. Of...
The midfield player, a fantastic midfield player on the team, sister of Siobhan. So she has heard it today, and we don't know because... Niall is away, so yeah. Hot Press came on board.
I'll finish up with another a piece called "You Make Me Happy." Is this more yourself and Carol have worked together for a long time now?
Eons.
Is it more in the jazz area that you would normally place yourselves?
Well, even this one is more jazz pop. You know, we've always had a very strong pop element, and we have always been lovers of music. All kinds of music. And I always hated being pinned down to anything, but there's always a strong element of jazz. We both love jazz. And
You Make Me Happy isn't it?
You Make Me Happy is a kind of jazz pop.
Right. Well, we'll have listen to a little bit of it. And let us hope that we are singing Come On Ireland, giving us the right to dream. Let us hope we're singing that for quite a lot of the time over the next couple of weeks. And enjoy the match tomorrow morning, Maria.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. That's Maria Walsh. And here is Maria and Carol Nelson with You Make Me Happy.
I might have worries, yeah, I might have some.
A little flavour there of You Make Me Happy from Maria Walsh and Carol Nelson. And of course, Maria and Carol deeply involved in the anthem for the current Irish team, Come On Ireland, giving us the right to dream. That is the anthem for the World Cup team playing in Australia. Tomorrow morning, 11 o'clock, is that first match, and that will be available, of course, across all RTE platforms, television, radio and online. Now, before we go to our final item this evening, let me tell you about tomorrow night. We will be at the Galway International Arts Festival, annual feast of drama, circus, exhibition, big top music, talks and street performances. We will be in the festival gallery. Tomorrow I will have as guests Colm and Brenda Meaney, who star in Enda Walsh's Bedbound, Luke Murphy and Darcy Grant, who bring two sensational dance and circus shows to the festival. In fact, I believe the Darcy Grant one is the biggest indoor event that has ever come to the festival. That's The Pulse, and Volcano, the Luke Murphy piece that we'll be talking about as well. We'll also talk to artists Lorraine Tuck and Brian Cross. And musical act on the day, the sensational Bridget Maypower, who has just released her album Dream from the Deep Well. So tomorrow night, 6:30, to hear all that's going on in Galway at the Arts Festival Arena here on RT Radio 1. We will be there on Friday night as well, but tomorrow's
tomorrow's guest list. Quite the list indeed, I think you will agree. Now, last October, out of nowhere, came a TV series called The Bear, set around a failing Chicago sandwich shop named The Beef. It captured the intense drama of a restaurant. It was a proper sensation, and just this month, it was nominated for 13 Emmy Awards. Now, The Bear is back for a new 10-part season in which the staff of The Beef prepare to reopen as a high-end restaurant called The Bear. Jen Gannon has been eagerly awaiting this moment and she's here to tell us about it. I can remember, Jen Gannon, when you came in to talk about season one of The Bear and you were excited, shall we say,
I was,
having watched that season one. Just remind us of that setup and what the dynamic that it created really in around this whole idea of a restaurant-based drama.
Yeah, so this was basically, you have Jeremy Allen White's character, who is Carmi Brizzato, and he is coming back from New York as this Michelin star chef, and he was left this spot, this rundown, you know, sandwich spot called The Beef that his brother Michael used to run. Now, Michael, this was a surprise to him because Michael died by suicide and he wasn't expecting to be left this place. Yeah. And he wanted to turn the fortunes of The Beef around and use his chef in nous to kind of elevate it. But he inherited this ragtag group of the people that worked in the restaurant who weren't exactly enthusiastic about him taking over. And it was really him trying to grapple with, you know, dealing with grief, dealing with coming back to his family, dealing with coming back to Chicago, but also trying to galvanize this group and make them, you know, work towards a goal and have kind of pride in their work. And it really just was like Full Metal Jacket, I was saying, like meets Kitchen Confidential, Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential. And it was so intense. It was like a Steven Soderbergh film about a kitchen, which was just blistering for
me. What I remember most about that first season, I only saw a couple of episodes of it, but what I remember most was the pace of it. I mean, it was a frantic pace from the outset. You arrived in the kitchen and the obvious comparisons were made to what's his name, the cursing,
Gordon Ramsay, Kitchen Nightmares.
You know, it was that kind of dynamic that you had there, the noise of a kitchen, the personalities rubbing
up off
each other.
You didn't have a minute to lose concentration or, you know, check your phone or do anything. Like, it was 30 minutes every episode and there was 1 hour-long episode. But then they did this amazing, like, one-shot kind of for this second last episode, which was just unbelievable. One of the best episodes of telly I think I've seen.
One big long shot.
And if you've seen something like Succession, the way that they did that with, you know, the big surprise episode this season, won't give any spoilers. I think everybody knows by now, but like it's done in that kind of pace and that same way where you feel like you're right in there and you're in that anxiety driven kind of, you know, restaurant atmosphere.
And I suppose because many people who have not watched all of season one or who missed out on season one of The Bear, they probably will. Do you need to watch?
I think so.
Season one before you get stuck into season two.
I think
two?
You need to at least give the last couple of episodes a watch, so you get the vibe, and then you understand where you're launching into, because they do launch straight away into season two. You're not getting your hand held here.
No,
and
you're expected to know who all the characters are, etc. So it would be good to have that before you start watching episode two. One thing that was there in season one, which seems to me, from what I've seen of the first episode of season two, the relationship of Carmi with his cousin seems to be growing in a new direction. So you might explain that dynamic from season one into season two.
I think that Richie is
the cousin.
Yeah, cousin Richie, who's played by Ebon Moss-Bachrach, who people might remember as Desi from Girls. But he was one of the standouts of last season because he is this hothead, this very macho kind of presence who's always chiding Carmi, but also kind of wants to prove himself to him. He's a divorced dad and he kind of has this image as being a bit of a deadbeat. He lounges around, he, you know, makes himself useless, he's getting under everybody's feet in the restaurant, trying to help out but not helping. And this season that relationship just changes because they are close, as in he loved, you know, Michael, Carmi's brother, but he also feels abandoned by Carmi. A lot of people feel abandoned by Carmi in it because he left to go to New York and make his name out there. But this season you see Carmi trying to install, like, instill some pride into Richie, and he sends him off to learn, you know, the ways of the kitchen and how to almost how to, you know, function as a maitre d' and a server properly. And at the start, he feels like, oh, I'm just being gotten rid of. And this is in episode 7. It's called Forks, and I think it's one of the highlights of the season.
Yeah.
And you see him, you know, really going from resentment and hating being in this Michelin star restaurant and being treated like a nobody to achieving. And it's done over the course of a half an hour, and it's so well done. And it's his performance, I think, is one of the ones that people will be talking about, because he kind of imbues him with this sensitivity that, you know, Richie could have been a one note, he could have been a joke, and he's not.
Yeah,
he
is somebody that I must say, if I haven't seen, I've only seen the first episode of the series, and I thought, oh, I'm interested in him, because there was something going on. He was looking at old pictures from his childhood.
He wants to get a garner a closer relationship with his ex-wife and his daughter, who he's dying to get Taylor Swift tickets for, and I think we can all relate to that at the moment.
Does he know you have to pre-book a pre-buy?
I think he's getting them by nefarious means, though. Knowing Richie.
Okay, well, good luck, Richie, with the purchase of those tickets. However, one of the main things that starts out at the beginning of season two is they're in financial trouble. Are they ever not in financial trouble,
and
really and truly?
What I kind of love about The Bear, because it is just this, you know, almost like the American version of Shameless in a way. They are always on the edge of absolute collapse and absolute disaster. And you see Carmi's sister, who is called, well, her nickname is Sugar, Natalie. She comes in to her own and she wants to actually manage things. Well, she's reluctantly trying to get a shape on the financial side of things that Michael has left them in turmoil. And it's kind of digs in more to the Brizzato family background and why they're so loosey-goosey with this money. And you know, you see Oliver Platt as he was in...
He's the uncle.
Uncle Jimmy, who lends them the money, and he's kind of, you know, we don't know where he's getting this money from, and we don't know what the stakes are for him. And that's something that may be explored again in season three. But you're getting closer and closer to understanding the motivations of Carmi, why he might have left, why he feels
the way he does
about his family, and why they feel the way they do about him, because it's chaotic, to say the least.
Right, so this is Carmi, played by Jeremy Allen White. Sydney, who's one of the workers, we'll come to her in a minute. She's an important character. Sydney, played by Ayo Edebin. Carmi's sister, Sugar, is the nickname. Natalie is her name, played by Abby Elliott. And they're all trying to appear very professional as they speak to Uncle Jimmy, played by Oliver Platt, about wanting to open this high-end restaurant. One of the problems, of course, is that in the background, there's an alarm going off all the time. A little bit of language in the midst of all of this. I think it's probably Cousin Richie off in the background.
It always is.
Trying to turn off the alarm that gives us the bad language. Here we go.
This is coming from a place of wanting to start fresh and clean. I love this place. I love this city. I want to start our first business here. I want it to be a real business, an honest business with honest partners.
We want to do high-level dining and hospitality and beverages, and we can and we will, because we know that any good restaurant starts with dedication to service and taking care of the customer.
We drafted a quick term sheet that specifically lays out not only our business prospectus, but an execution guide, as well as a return portfolio.
Hey, Richard, will you turn that fucking thing off, please?
Right.
What the fuck are we doing here? What's going on? What are you doing?
Mikey was telling you the truth.
About the petting zoo?
What? No.
Mini golf.
No, about franchising. He wanted to franchise this place. He wanted to open a restaurant with me.
How the fuck do you know?
Because we found your money.
We found your money. So there we have, that's Uncle Jimmy, played by Oliver Platt, and Natalie, Carmi's sister, Carmi himself, Jeremy Allen White and Abby Elliott, respectively. I have to say, I was listening to that this afternoon, and the alarm, and it's even worse when you're listening to it on radio, and it changes about three times during that clip, because the pace was frantic in season one. They have slowed down in season two.
They have.
But they still have annoying alarms and things
still,
like that.
The tension and anxiety are definitely still there. And it's still because every episode it's ticking down the clock until the restaurant is having this grand opening. So you still have that. That's at the heart of it. But like, there is this kind of different, you know, I think the creator, Christopher Storer, he's willing to take more risks this season because the show has been a success. So I think it does have that bang and crash element to it. But you have episodes like the second episode, Pasta, and then the fourth episode, Honeydew. There is this very gentle, impressionistic feel to it. And the cinematography, I have to say, by Andrew Wade is stunning. Mm. It is really like concentrating on the beauty of cooking, of food, and why food is an art form. And, you know, why it concentrates on why these people who are so disparate, yeah, such a mad, you know, grab bag of people, why they want to cook, why
just
they love
one
it.
One thing before we move on, Sydney is an important character here. She's kind of going to step up a rung because of the changes in personnel, which there's no point in trying to explain all that, but she's basically going to get a promotion because things are changing.
She is trying to step up and focus more on being a leader and being like Carmi's, you know, right hand woman. And she's going around with, like, you know, Mike Krzyzewski's, Coach K's successful strategies in basketball and using that as this guide, as a talisman for her new role. And she wants to make a go of things. You're kind of delving more into the background of the other characters as well. And she wants
to
have
this
success.
We see them outside of the restaurant as well.
Yeah, she wants to prove to her father who's in this that how serious she is and how she wants to make a go of it.
Is this a high recommendation? Have you watched all 10 episodes?
I've watched all 10 episodes. And just to say, I know people are worried because it's getting a lot of criticism thrown at it for being a bit too starry. And I know people are going to talk about episode 6, which is huge. It's called Fishes. And it's a bottle episode set around Thanksgiving. And it has, spoiler alert, cover your ears now, everybody from like Jamie Lee Curtis to Bob Odenkirk kind of swings by.
So everybody wants
but
to be in it.
It's a great, and I think from episode 6 onwards, it goes into this crescendo of brilliance. It's alarmingly good.
Okay, let us move on to the second series you've been watching. Released just as Wimbledon finished, up comes 15 Love, a new 6-part series on Prime Video set in the world of elite tennis. Irish newcomer Ella Lily Highland, I was talking about her in a quite an arty video last week, and she's astonishing in that. And she's really strong here as Justin Pearce, too. Once promising teen champion, and her coach Glenn Lapthorne, played by Aidan Turner. The dynamic here, it is about the two of them and their past and the nature of their relationship when she was just a teenager and he was the star pupil, he was the star coach.
Yeah, so we meet Justine. She's this willful, very frustrated young woman, and it's 5 years after she's had this wrist injury, and she's kind of losing herself in, you know, a party lifestyle because she's trying to bury her past. And it's not just the failure of her career, it's because she had dealings with her old coach Glenn, who's played by Aidan Turner, and he's very suave, and he comes back into her life because she's working as a physiotherapist in this elite academy, and he's working with a high profile star and looking to seek out fresh talent in the academy. But it's all about his past sexual misconduct, you know, in relation to Justine.
Let's listen to a clip where this is where he suddenly appears back where she is now working because she injured her hand so badly she had to stop playing tennis, and he's happy to see her, he says.
That is not how I meant things to happen.
So you're coming back to Longwood?
Yeah, I am. And I don't want things to be difficult between us.
You mean you don't want them to be difficult for you?
Oh, God, you still think that I just sailed off with another player after your injury?
No, I'm fine now, actually. I've got on with things.
Good. Me too.
Yeah, I hear you're scraping by. Look, I've made things work in my space.
Right, I mean, I started out at Longwood too.
So you're going to play Who Was Here First?
No, but I was.
Well, your coaching career only started when you met me.
Okay, Justine, I don't want to argue.
No, you should enjoy your spectacular triumph.
It's good to see you again.
Lily Highland there is Justine Pearce and Glenn Lapthorne, played by Aidan Turner, in a scene from 15 Love. What's the scripting like here? Was that to get the cut to the bone on it?
Yeah, for me it was a bit over the top in the tone, I think, for me. Like, there is this layer of ambiguity to Justine's story, which is fine and that is understandable, but I think it doesn't dig enough into the psychology or the complexities of something, you know, a topic like grooming. And I think she's more portrayed as this femme fatale almost, that has this obsession with him or this misplaced lust, and it kind of turns it into this, you know, psychosexual drama rather than a study of that kind of, you know, grooming atmosphere or, you know, taking advantage of young people that it could have been.
Enough in it in the performances to keep you watching.
I think she is something special. And I think, you know, she's a very promising actor. And I think she's the one that makes it even slightly compelling and makes you want to continue watching
it. Yeah, it's very, very easy to watch on screen, that's for sure. That's Ella Lily Highland as Justine Pearce in 15 Love. You can stream all of the episodes of 15 Love from Friday the 21st of July on Prime Video. And the season, Bertu, is available on Disney Plus from today. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. I'm Dean Pastor Devine and Paula Shields researched. Aisling Grufferty was on sound. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you from Galway tomorrow night. Looking forward to that enormously. John Creedon. Oh, no, he's not going to be with you shortly. There's something else happening and you'll be told about it in a minute.